Session number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 23.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 23. We were talking about support units, Mr. Hawksworth. What other assistance could you call upon?
Well, you mentioned our own mortar platoon, the gun, the 25-pounder gun housed in the medium battery Royal Artillery. Further back still, there were some guns of a bigger calibre, manned, I believe, by the Americans. But for obvious reasons, we prefer not to involve them in our close support system. In order to practice this system of close support with live ammunition, certainly on one occasion, an exercise was mounted whereby on delivery of a certain code word, this would be brought into action. This proved to be a great interest both to myself and others. Certainly the troops enjoyed it. We were previously briefed and told that, not disclosing the code word, of course, that we were in a situation whereby, should we become nearly overwhelmed, we could bring shells down almost onto our own position and flabbergast the Chinks. It's all very well doing this on a map, and it can be done accurately on a map, but there's nothing like seeing it done physically properly, and so our commanding officer, and I think my company commander was behind it, decided to let's have it live. It also lifted the morale a bit. Occasionally we were getting a bit stiff sitting around during the day and working all night. And therefore, on this particular occasion, during the middle of the afternoon, in order to excite the Chinamen and interest ourselves, we were all told to get below ground, wearing our steel helmets, which we rarely bothered. Our green berets were the order of the day. And at a given time, the code word was passed and the supporting weapons opened up. It proved to be the most effective display I've ever seen. The mortars, our own mortar platoon, were first in, of course, being the nearest behind us, and they proceeded to drop bombs less than 50 feet in front of our own trenches, blowing certain clods of earth into the faces of the disgusted onlookers who immediately took cover. This was sharply followed by 4.2 mortar shells, which were even larger calibre, from the gun lines, who created air bursts about the same area. By this time, the 25-pounders decided their turn had come, and they were lobbing shells about 100 yards in front of our positions. And then the medium batteries, having been called through, considered the pace the floor of the valley. And I just don't know how any body of Chinese troops could have ever walked through that lot. Of course, we were fortunate. We at that time, unlike our predecessors, had all the equipment, we had all the clothing, we even had our tank support, which I hadn't mentioned. The tanks joined in, firing their 20-pound guns, and this went on for possibly 2 minutes or so. I hate to wonder what expense was incurred, but it was nevertheless a proper rehearsal. Much enjoyed by all, and we ended that day knowing full well that should the Chinese get into a huddle and mass themselves on our front wire, then we'd certainly never get through.
What other support did you have? You've gone through the artillery. You mentioned tanks.
The tanks, early days on our first arrival in the line, we had a tank in support of each platoon, or possibly two per company. I forget quite which. But the idea in those days was to provide a platoon with a close support weapon, and what more close could he get to conquer a tank sitting on the reverse side of your platoon area, with a twin beater gun, half an inch calibre, and the 20-pounder gun, which is deadly accurate. The tactical situation, as far as they were concerned, was that during the day they would pull slightly downhill to the reverse slope of the platoon area, and as night drew, they would move forward until they were in a hold-down position, ready to engage the enemy should they be required so to do. They occasionally had practice shoots, usually at night, knowing that should they hit anything, it would be one of them. We made friends with these tankies, and in fact, I recognised and renewed acquaintance with several of the tank crews who I'd met in Berlin at Wilmersdorf, when they were members of the Independent Tank Brigade.
Can you take me now through the time that you're in the lines in Korea and the kind of things you got involved in?
Well, fortunately, and I think that's a proper way to say it, we were never involved or called upon to act in an attack either at battalion level or company level, apart from one occasion when it was decided to attack and occupy a feature called John, which was in close proximity to the left forward company of our battalion area, which happened to be my company. And the platoon, which was closely associated with this position, had been causing some problem, was commanded by Michael McBain. In fact, they were so close to this Chinese situation that I often jokingly said to McBain, "You're nearer to the Chinese, why don't you attach yourself to them for rations?" The preparation for this company attack were duly put into operation. Sergeant Major Chadwick, who had previously been in charge of the mortar platoon, was the company sergeant major. Arrangements had been made for aircraft supplied from an American aircraft carrier to soften up the hill position, which was due to be attacked. In due course, some hours later than expected, these aircraft arrived, dropped several bombs, which to us appeared to be of exceedingly small caliber, and disappeared. Within a few minutes, the decision was taken to move forward, and the attacking company started to pass through our communication trenches towards the gap in the wire through which they would make up their assault. I vividly remember amongst the leading group was the padre. It was a typical padre's position at the head of the men, and shortly followed by my friend Sergeant Major Chadwick, who was holding a small Chinese hurricane lamp in one hand and a box of matches in the other. And when I gave him a critical look, he said, "Well, it's bound to be bloody dark in those hutches, Robert. I'm going in prepared." They were about to move out and commence the attack when the order came over the air, "Stop." And for reasons best known to our commanding officer, the attack never materialised. It was cancelled, and that company planned to assault the hill were withdrawn. And I believe one of the reasons for the cancellation was that the Americans had somehow got the maps upside down and bombed the wrong Chinese position, which incidentally proved to be unoccupied in any case. We were given the job, of course, of giving supporting fire, and I had organised every brain gun on our company position into a situation ready to deliver a massive supporting light machine gun fire when called upon to do so. So back went our machine guns to their proper places, and routine returned to normal. I must also add that this was to be a daylight attack, which was an unusual feature in those days. Had it occurred, It would have been a unique occasion, because since the war had become static, there had been no forward movement on such a scale.
Were there any other events that you can recall?
One incident springs to mind, which occurred at night. On our right flank, the position had been occupied, or was at that time occupied, by the 3rd Battalion of the Royal Australian Rifles, or Royal Australian Regiment, who had sent out an exceedingly strong fighting patrol of some 30 men. Apparently, during the course of operations, they ran into an ambush, the noise and battle of which we began to hear about midnight that night. And subsequently, my company commander, Reggie, got in touch with me over the radio and said that we're being called upon to provide artificial illumination in order to help to extricate these unfortunate Australians, some of who seem to have lost their way and were in fact withdrawn toward the Chinese position. I quickly mustered our four available 2-inch mortars, all available parachute flares, and started to pump these flare bombs into the sky. So, eventually, one of our company sergeant majors took a rescue party out into the valley, and assisted by the flare which we had sent up, eventually brought them in.
Where did you go? Were you in the same position most of the time, or had you moved? Did you move to other positions?
No, we were during our tour of duty in Korea. We moved possibly four times, and only one. Never. No, I think we never reoccupied the same position. This was of course a sensible plan of action, but it also meant that the Durham Light Infantry occupied four different frontline positions, reconstructing each one in turn.
And the same routine.
And the same routine. Certainly our company maintained the same routine, so our company commander must have been quite happy with that sort of arrangement. I certainly was, and so were the men.
Have you any other outstanding memories of Korea?
Oh, finally, one unfortunate casualty which occurred in my own company. It was during the early evening before a patrol was due to pass through the wire on a certain duty, and a small group of men, acting against strict orders not so to do, were priming their grenades in their underground bunker. I was in close vicinity, not knowing that this was taking place, of course, when I heard the dull thud of an explosion, and much to my dismay, was informed immediately by a chap who dashed out that a grenade had somehow exploded. Miraculously, only one person sustained injuries of the five men who had been in close proximity to this grenade, who received a severe wound to his head. He was quickly evacuated, and he was our first medevac via helicopter.
When you changed positions, did you have a period of rest taken out?
Yes, when our term of duty had finished in the front line, the relief in the line place, as previously explained, and usually, in order to keep silence, we would march possibly 2 miles to the rear, and then we'd be met and picked up by transport, taken to our reserve position, which was usually in a secluded valley somewhere. And although we were in a rest area, defensive positions would be prepared and set up should the occasion arise, we would have to man them. And then the normal daily routine would be reintroduced, and people would walk about enjoying the freedom. Sport was organised, boxing matches, etc. A certain amount of individual and section training would take place, but generally speaking, physical fitness and sporting activities and other recreation was the order of the day.
Did discipline stay at a high level? Did you have any men or that needed to be removed?
No, apart from the usual silly mistake, there was no crime worth mentioning. We had, as a matter of form, as a matter of routine, out of the line certainly, a provost sergeant and a tent, which, let's face it, wouldn't have contained a person determined to escape. I think we went through the motions as far as that's concerned. One or two people were confined, but not to committing any serious crime. So So I could safely say that we had no crime.
You'd spent Christmas in Korea. What kind of Christmas did you have?
Well, we were fortunate. We were actually out in a rest area during that Christmas. And we made the most of it, as soldiers want to do. It was a most enjoyable day. We had, as I previously mentioned, these typically excellent fresh rations, huge turkeys. So I've never seen turkeys as big since, ever. And the York hams, I've said before, were absolutely marvellous. The troops had a magnificent Christmas dinner at the agreed lunchtime, and the commanding officer, Peter Jeffries, visited each company in turn, and customary, the sergeants of each company served the dinner to the men.
You mentioned some incident of Christmas cards in the line.
This is possibly a subject not widely known, but I certainly know about it. Whilst we're in the line in one certain position around the Christmas time, a Christmas card appeared and given to me to scrutinise, had obviously been prepared by our friends across the valley. Fairly good Christmas soldier, or words to that effect. And I was mystified. We weren't in the habit of exchanging Christmas cards in the middle of the valley floor. Without going into detail, I also learned shortly afterwards that one of our officers had constructed a rough post box near to our forward position, into which he had invited our friend across the valley to deposit their welcome. Also used it himself to return the favours. No names, no pack drill, but you silly sod, Mike, you might have got your hand blown off.
In the time that you were there, you would have some experience of the soldiers of other nationalities. How did you find them? Australians, Americans, Turks?
We saw little of the Turks. The Turks, I believe, were used more as a maintenance unit in the rear area. The Americans are a mystery to me. How they managed to evade 100% casualties, I never know to this day. Complete with their donut machines, ice cream mixers, espresso coffee machines, etc., all on the company position. I'm surprised any Americans returned from Korea. The Australians disappointed me, and I think my comrades will agree, certainly those who knew the Australians who we met in Tobruk. Discipline, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm talking about rest areas now, the discipline, as far as the Australian was concerned, had gone out of the bloody window. They used to slouch through our lines to the garrison cinema, despite the fact we had a double apron barbed wire fence around it. They cut the way through there. They didn't respond to any order from any type of NCO or officer, certainly their own. And I can honestly say, certainly the odd battalions that we saw there from the Australian side of things were a bloody scruffy lot. Well, I mean, they weren't all that clever at patrolling, let's face it. One final point sticks in my mind about Korea is an arrangement, a rather clever arrangement, whereby an artificial moonlight was created. This confused the Chinese and restricted movements by night, I suppose. Somewhere to the rear, possibly a mile or so, the Royal Engineers or some group of soldiers were manning the searchlight detachments, which when brought into action, bathed the front line, the valley, and the front of the enemy positions in a ghostly blue haze, giving sufficient light to deter any movement, certainly from his side, and ours for that matter. This blue light, this ghostly blue light, would have possibly been switched on every night for some 20 days, when suddenly one night, it would be not there, it would be switched out. This would encourage, we hope, the Chinese to come out of the foxholes on the reverse slopes of their positions and start digging on the front. When, much to their surprise, on would come the light and everything would fly back at them. The artificial moonlight. I believe this had been used previously in Normandy, but this was the first time our chap had seen it. It was quite effective.
When did you leave Korea, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, the main body left shortly after the war had finished, but I left previously, on the 16th of August in 1953, to be precise. I was sent for and detailed to proceed to Kure in Japan for the job of a camp sergeant major capacity at British Commonwealth Forces headquarters at Kure. There had seemingly been a bit of trouble amongst the staff there, not necessarily a mutiny, but I was sent there as a disciplinarian. I was flown out from Seoul, arriving at a place called Iwakuni in the Inland Sea, from where I was taken to Kure by a fast motorboat. I had a good job there, very special job. Major Caton of the Queen's Regiment was camp commandant, who made me quite welcome. My predecessor, incidentally, had been Sergeant Major Bob Hay from our battalion, whom I relieved in that capacity. There I spent 3 happy months doing my job. I got on well with the troops, and they reciprocated. The mornings were spent on muster parades, various inspections, and a certain amount of weapon training, but every afternoon I was able to go out sailing in 2 small sailing boats which were made available for our use. Later, in the year, after about 3 months, when the advance party was being formed to proceed to Egypt from Japan, from Korea, I was asked at long range, would I be ready to proceed with the advance party representing our battalion in Egypt? This I agreed to.
When did this take place?
This, I went there in 553, 3 months later, about the middle of August, 17th of August, in actual fact.
What was the battalion doing there?
In Egypt? Well, the situation in the canal zone, which was the only piece of Egyptian land we were allowed to stand upon at that time, was being defended, I should say, against looters, odd rioters. The local nappy shops up and down the small garrison towns were being looted. People were being mugged, to use a common everyday expression. And the British troops' job was to contain as far as possible this sort of situation. The married families were being taken out, encouraged to move as soon as possible, because the situation really was fraught with danger. So once our battalion arrived, we were put to use. We were based at a camp at Fanara camp, a typical wartime desert camp. And so in actual fact, the wheel had turned full circle. We were back in Egypt, not far from the Bitter Lakes, where we'd done a certain amount of training and fallen into the water off the side of ships.
Did you get involved in any particularly unpleasant incidents?
No, we did our duties, sort of a minor sort of garrison duty. There were 2 main tasks to be performed by the troops available. Our battalion was one of which. Incidentally, we had now become part of the 1st Guards Brigade. Being part of a Guards Brigade. Previously, it was the top of Hellfire Pass a long time ago. The main task was to guard a huge ammunition dump at a place called Abu Sultan, which took a company and a half of men. Even the ammunition dump wasn't safe from these Egyptian marauders, who, in their total ignorance, would attempt to steal items of extremely sensitive explosive material and, in certain circumstances, blowing themselves up. This was an interesting job. Once again, most of the activity was done at night under the cover of darkness, And so we proceeded to reverse as we did in Korea. Rested during the day and 100% out every night. And we didn't have one infiltrator whilst we were there. Another job, which not dissimilar, was a water purification plant, which was based on that misnomed stretch of water, the Sweetwater Canal. How the hell it got called Sweetwater Canal, God only knows. However, the gypos, as we call them, had attempted to destroy or certainly disturb the operational prospects of this water purification plant, and so we had a permanent guard on this place. Otherwise, normal battalion routine. Companies went off on route marches. We had rifle competitions on the nearby range, inter-platoon competitions, football. We thoroughly thrashed the Irish Guards at rugby whilst we were there. And I think most important as far as recreation is concerned, we had occasionally passing through the canal in each direction, ships of the Royal Navy, to mention too the HMS Decoy and HMS Diadem, whose crews were rapidly accepted an invitation to come ashore and be entertained. I remember the Decoy regulating officer who became exceedingly ill after 3 days at the bar, which he refused to leave. Nevertheless, he recovered sufficiently well to join his ship, and off they went. Somewhere knocking about are the plaques of these ships, which were presented to us on their departure.
Who was commanding the battalion in the area?
Crackers May at that time, and it was during our stay there that the CO sent for me, whilst I was occupying the capacity as a drill sergeant, a senior sergeant major, and told me that the time had come for me to take up a yet another detached post, and naming them both, the first being sergeant major at the Apprentice Boys School in Harrogate, and the second one being depot sergeant major of our own Durham Itinerary Depot. And I needn't tell you that I accepted the latter with a certain amount of alacrity.
When did you return to England to take up that post?
We left on the 5th of June in 1955 on HMT Lancashire, the last trip that troop ship ever made. She was, well, if she wasn't broken up, she'd have been sold to the Greeks. That's patently obvious. And if the Greeks had her, she'd still be floating around somewhere. But we left on the troop ship Lancashire. A most uneventful journey. We made our own entertainment, and upon arrival at Liverpool, docks found to our disgust that there was a bloody strike on. Nothing was moving. But Basher Edwards, our regimental sergeant major, had a talk with the CO. He then came to us, company sergeant major, and said, "Look, let's unload the bloody ship ourselves," which we continued to do. One company per time, one company per shift, 4 hours unloading, and within a day and a half, we'd unloaded the complete ship of every item of baggage, beating the docker's record by 4 days. Once it had been done, a fleet of coaches arrived, taking us once more nearer to our home than we've been for quite some time.
Did you get the chance of leave again?
Yes, we arrived at the Barnard Castle Camp. And as was usual, the usual procedure was adopted. People were asked if they wanted to go on leave, were granted leave, and off they went.
When did you take up your post as depot sergeant major?
In February 1958.
What did those duties entail?
No, I think I've got that date wrong, in actual fact. I was on my way to the Trucial Oman. After we landed in England in 55 from Egypt, it was during that time, shortly afterwards, that I took up my post at Bransworth Camp and where I remained for 2 years as the depot sergeant major.